This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I will defend the things I did in the 1970s and 80s on the basis of the circumstances that existed at that time. One of the reasons that I moved away from my former compatriots is that they simply refuse to acknowledge that the world has changed, that the economy is different, that we have different problems.
Today on Sea Change Radio, we take a little time out from all things sustainability to analyze how the Republican Party has led us into some very uncertain and dangerous times with a white supremacist occupying the White House. To help us dissect the roots of modern republicanism, we hear from author and economist Bruce Bartlett, who worked for both the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations before defecting from the party in 2003. We learn about Bartlett's own political journey, debate the legacy of Ronald Reagan, and discuss how this country's conservative party has squandered an opportunity by not being the party of conservationism. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Bruce Bartlett. He's an author, an economist, an historian. Bruce, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Happy to be here.
So first, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your political career? I think we need that background before we dive into understanding a little bit more on the roots of republicanism.
Yeah, I've probably been a Republican, a Republican, really for most of my life. I don't really know why. I vaguely remember supporting Nixon in 1960 and Goldwater in 64 when I was in middle school. And I came to Washington, D.C. To go to graduate school. And I began looking around for a job, and a number of friends suggested that I look on Capitol Hill. And I, various ways, I somehow or other latched on to Jack Kemp, where I went to work as a staff economist and a tax policy analyst. And I worked there on what was called the Kemp-Roth bill, and which later became the 1981 tax cut. And so I worked there for a couple of years, and then I moved over to the Senate, and I worked for a senator named Roger Jepson, and then worked for him for a couple of years, and then I went to work on the committee called the Joint Economic Committee, and which is sort of the congressional counterpart to the President's Council of Economic Advisors. And I did other things for a few years, and then in 1987, I was asked to go to work on the White House staff, the domestic policy staff, and I did that for about 2 years, and then towards the end of the Reagan administration, I transferred over to the Treasury Department, where I stayed throughout the entire George H.W. Bush administration. And since then, I've worked as for think tanks and as a syndicated columnist and various other writing-related occupations.
Now, explain the light bulb moment you had when you became a Republican apostate.
Oh, I can date it precisely. It was November 22nd, 2003. And what happened on that day is that the Congress, with George W. Bush's blessing, passed the Medicare Part D legislation. Now, in those days, I was, you know, very libertarian, and I really believed all that rhetoric about cutting spending and entitlements and all that sort of thing. And I thought Republicans were put on the earth to get rid of entitlements, not to create new ones. And frankly, I was just appalled at the gross hypocrisy. Now, I didn't have any problem particularly with, you know, having a prescription drug benefit attached to Medicare. What I was appalled by was the fact that there was not one penny of financing. The whole program which to this day costs every year about 1% of GDP, was just put on the national credit card. And I was just shocked. Maybe I was naive, but in any event, that was the event. And from then on, I began viewing, you know, everything the party did with a great deal more skepticism. It was like reaching the peak of a mountain, and you start rolling down the other side. And as time went by, other things that perhaps I had not paid enough attention to began to bother me, and everything about George W. Bush bothered me, and I finally decided to write a book about it, which I did. It was called Imposter and was published in 2005. This got me this book, which attacked George Bush purely from the right. I mean, everything I wrote about him was quoting conservatives about unconservative policies that he did, of which there were quite a few. But nevertheless, this got me defenestrated, you might say, from the conservative movement and the Republican Party. And I literally lost every friend that I had in Washington. I thought that I was helping the Republican Party. The way I saw it is that Republicans were going to be in big trouble when Bush's second term was over, and they needed to understand the roots of his failures, his mistakes. I thought that would help them get a nominee in 2008 who could win. Honest to God, that's what I thought. And I still think I was right about that, although I'm not a Republican anymore. I think they should have listened to what I had to say. But in any event, I was treated as a traitor. But the lucky thing for me is that I'm basically a misanthrope and bit of a recluse as well. So I didn't really need the camaraderie of these people. But, you know, my drift continued. I live in Virginia. We don't register by party in this state. You just vote in whichever primary you feel like voting in. And I remember in 2006, I made a conscious decision to vote in the Democratic Party primary that year to kind of mark my transition away from the Republican Party. And I've sort of continued to move leftward ever since.
If you were still part of the Republican Party and still had ears listening to what you had to say, it seems to me like there would be a compelling case to conservatives to be in line with the Green New Deal, with environmental policy, which is long-term thinking, which can not only give us clean air, clean water, but can create a pretty profound revolution in terms of how we work as a society.
Well, look, it's actually even easier argument to make than you think, because a lot of economists are now saying we're on the brink of a recession. Now, as you know, Keynes argued that what you really needed to in a recession was to get aggregate spending in the economy, spending on goods and services, going to mobilize money and get it and increase the turnover of money, and public works is the best way to do that. Now, you may disagree with me on this, but I think our ability to halt global warming or climate change is extremely limited, even if we had the commitment and the international cooperation that would be needed. But I think in the near term, what we have and have to deal with, you know, extremely quickly are the consequences. We're going to have more, we're having more and more problems with flooding and intensive and increasingly intensive storm activities and things of this sort. We need to be building seawalls. We need to be refurbishing our infrastructure to deal with a world in which, you know, a climate change is going to be impacting on our infrastructure and causing all kinds of problems that we're not at all prepared to deal with. And right now, the interest rates are literally zero. We can borrow trillions of dollars if we want to build this stuff. So you've got the need for public works on a macroeconomic basis to coincides with the need for public works from an environmental point of view, and you've got essentially free money to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we're going to look back in years from now and say, God, what fools we were not to prepare when it was very easy to do so, because it's going to be much, much more costly in the future.
Like dogs sniff a berry bone, turn back the clock, take it in stride. Bright eyes will roll as bombs explode. You burn through time, say I got
mine. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to economist and author Bruce Bartlett. So in 2003, November 22nd, 2003, this deficit spending had kind of reached a boiling point for you internally. Is that a correct assessment, or is that a mischaracterization?
I mean, I was still a Republican at that time. I was still a libertarian. I believed we needed to cut government spending. And it just appalled me that from that point of view, that my party was creating a new unfunded entitlement.
So I want to understand how you were able to kind of square Reaganomics with what was happening in 2003 under George W. Bush. I mean, Ronald Reagan tripled the deficit from $900 billion to $2.7 trillion, and we haven't really looked back since when Republicans are in charge. So was this something that just hadn't been on your radar? I mean, you're an economist.
Well, I think you have to look at this in a larger perspective. I mean, when I became politically active and politically aware, this was during the Great Society, you know? I mean, the Democrats had controlled Congress forever. We had, you know, new entitlement programs like Medicare being created, and you had a vast expansion of government. And in the 1970s, you know, we had a huge problem of inflation, and it seemed quite reasonable that the government spending and government in general were very much responsible for this problem. I mean, it sounds silly to say that I was upset because George Bush, I thought, was too much of a liberal. But remember, in 2000, he ran on a platform of compassionate conservatism, which really was, you know, at least from a Republican point of view, very much of a liberal platform. And of course, that was the last time any Republican even made the slightest effort to move towards the center, to move towards the left on any issues whatsoever. And so I will defend the things I did in the 1970s and 80s on the basis of the circumstances that existed at that time. One of the reasons that I moved away from my former compatriots is that they simply refused to acknowledge that the world has changed, that the economy is different, that we have different problems. I mean, my friend Larry Kudlow believes that inflation is always right around the corner, and that we have to, and that tax rates are very, very high and need to be slashed. And this is just nonsensical. Now, I should say one other thing was very important in terms of my intellectual transition, and that is I wrote a book. Was called The New American Economy.
And the subtitle for our listeners is The New American Economy, The Failure of Reaganomics and a New Way Forward, just as a preface there. So go on, sorry.
And now up until that time, ever since I was in college, I had thought that John Maynard Keynes was my enemy, you know, intellectually. And not that I put myself in his class, but Keynesian economics, economists associated with the Keynesian school, were my opposite number, so to speak. And when I was working on creating supply-side economics, I viewed this very much as the counter, the opposite of Keynesian economics. So I had planned on writing a lot of, you know, rehashing a lot of my previous writing and research on Keynes into this book. And I started reading the things he was saying in real time about the economy, which made much more sense to me than his technical writings had in the past. And I came to the, you know, what was then a reluctant conclusion, the Keynes have been right. And so here I had a second intellectual crisis, you see, is I had to admit that just about everything I had thought about economics for the previous 20 years or 30 years was wrong. And so I became very much of a pro-Keynes writer. And this was very, very helpful because this realization came to me just as the Great Recession began. And it was immediately obvious to me, immediately, that we had the exact same problem that Keynes was dealing with in the 1930s.
So now how do you view Ronald Reagan? Because I still see him as kind of the genesis of what we have today with Donald Trump.
I don't think that's right, but I can certainly see why someone would draw that conclusion. I think the way in which Reagan is most plowed the ground, shall we say, for Trump is that he, you know, was very much of enthralled with the common man, you know, and this is something that is very now popular in the Republican, in the right wing view of the world, is they're anti-elitist. They don't like university professors in states they control. They're slashing the budgets of the state universities and things like that. And Reagan, you know, really articulated that because, you know, he had a very modest educational career and was mostly an actor during his life. And so, I mean, he was absolutely not an intellectual, although he did like associating with intellectuals. But he always, you know, couched all of his policies and his rhetoric was very much aimed towards the common man. And well, of course, FDR did that too. But you contrast him to, say, Richard Nixon, who was very much of an elitist, possibly had the highest IQ of any president we've ever had, did a tremendous amount of stuff in the domestic area that he doesn't get credit for. But in any event, he was clearly not, you know, somebody who appealed to the common man. So I think you have to look at Reagan in contrast to Nixon, and also at the politics of the 1960s when Reagan was governor. And remember, this was the era of the Vietnam War protests, and you had a lot of activity and demonstrations on the college campuses, which were a big issue for conservatives. They really didn't, you know, believe that law and order stuff, and they hated demonstrations and long-haired hippies and marijuana and free sex and all that stuff, all that turmoil, social and cultural turmoil of the 1960s, very much shaped, I think, Reagan's view of elites and of intellectuals and people like that. And so in that sense, I think he kind of turned the Republican Party, which really in many ways was a party of the elites, as opposed to the Democrats, which were the party of the common man. He turned that in a different direction. And of course, George W. Bush carried on with that. Although George H.W. Bush was very, very much of a throwback to the more patrician, elitist type of Republican that Nixon had been. So, and then now you have Trump, who is, you know, down in the gutter with the racists and the garbage of American society.
bib. Are your hands getting filled? Won't you tell me, my brother? 'Cause there are stars up above. We can start moving forward.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Bruce Bartlett. He's a historian, an author, an economist. So the reason I think that Reagan is kind of the beginning of this is the allure of these endless tax cuts, which are very, very seductive to any politician. I mean, it's magical thinking, saying that you can just consistently cut taxes and get government out of the way. And that's a very powerful message. It's like if you read any George Lakoff, who talks about the strict father framing that Reagan kind of was at the forefront of, and that has perpetuated through a lot of the Republican messaging in terms of being anti-union, privatization, some of these buzzwords, and then the wedge issues like guns, gods, and gays. He allied himself with some pretty dark forces, I guess, is maybe a more generous reading.
I think you have to, especially with Reagan, separate his actions from his rhetoric. I mean, the way Reagan defended himself politically within the Republican Party from people on the right was by giving them thundering conservative rhetoric. But if you look at his actual policies, he very seldom delivered on that rhetoric. He did absolutely nothing for the pro-life people for 8 solid years. He would give speeches to the March for Life rallies and things of that sort, but he didn't do anything. And on taxes, although it's true he cut taxes quite significantly in 1981, he raised taxes almost every year afterwards. The 1982 tax increase raised revenues by about 1% of GDP. That's a lot. And he raised taxes 11 different times during his presidency. By his last year in office, he had raised taxes by about half of the 1981 tax cut. That is, he took back half of the tax cut with subsequent tax increases. And no Republican today would do that. I think that showed a lot of courage and a lot of sense of reality about the nature of the economy. And he was admitted to himself and in his policies that you weren't going to balance the budget by cutting spending. You had to raise revenues. And so I think that there's a lot of other policies as well where his rhetoric didn't match his actions, which were in fact fairly moderate, at least by Republican standards.
As someone who's a lifelong Democrat, I see this as a evolution, and you see it much more as a breaking. I see foxes being put in charge of the hen houses back in the 80s. You have James Watt as your Secretary of Interior, who was like this staunch anti-environmentalist. We have these examples all sprinkled throughout, and now we've kind of come to its fruition where you have pretty much every position in the Trump administration is a fox guarding the hen house.
Well, I can certainly see your point of view, but I think that people like Watt were exceptions in at that time, and now they're the rule. And I think that's an important difference. And it's not just at the top level. I mean, the people I see, you know, down through the ranks of, you know, being assistant secretaries and, you know, people like that who really run, you know, these departments, you're just seeing complete incompetence, people who have no training whatsoever in their field. And the only person you have talking about economic issues is Larry Kudlow, who I've known for 40 years, and I know for a fact he really has no clue as to what he's talking about. He plays an economist on TV, is about the best you can say for him. He knows the buzzwords, but it's all rhetoric. It's all designed for Wall Street consumption, for television consumption. He doesn't know anything whatsoever about academic economics, even conservative academic economics. You cannot possibly imagine somebody of the stature of, say, Martin Feldstein, who recently died, who was one of the preeminent economists of his generation and served as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers for Reagan. You can't imagine somebody of that stature anywhere within 1,000 miles of this administration.
I think we kind of agree. I guess it's just a question of whether or not we're viewing the exceptions to the rule, like a James Watt, in a generous reading where, well, most of them were fine, but this guy was bad, or you had these little bad seeds already planted. I mean, you can draw a direct line from a James Watt to a Ryan Zinke, who is just a know-nothing.
That's true, but didn't Reagan have Ruckelshaus at EPA?
Right, no, he had people, but I'm just saying a few of these bad apples kind of were allowed to kind of to fester, is the way I would view it. Of course, there was a lot more competence and education in Republican administrations from 1980 to 1992. I mean, there's no question about what we have now is completely off the rails. And it's just a question of how did we get there, you know? And I can't help but think that the seeds were sown in the Reagan era.
The seeds were sown by, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the rise of the internet, which basically destroyed the mainstream media, which we haven't talked about at all, but is extremely important, and the simultaneous rise of the alternate right-wing media, most especially Fox News, mm-hmm. and the way that it has just brainwashed an entire generation of people into, you know, just believing utter stupidity and conspiracy theories and crazy stuff.
Nixon would have finished out his term if Fox News were around in the early 70s, probably, right?
Oh, absolutely, no question about it. No question about it. And of course, the people who were in Congress, Republicans in Congress, you know, you had people who were patriots. They put the country first. And now there's no Republican would do that. Party over country is their unified world view. And so I think, you know, the cultural explanation, I think, is more persuasive to me even than the political explanation.
Couldn't agree more. Bruce Bartlett, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Okay.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Curtis Mayfield, Fog Swamp, and The Head in the Heart. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.